The intersection of endurance sport, health, fitness and life. Challenging conventional ideas and empowering people with the science of self-propelled motion. This is the Endurance Experience Podcast, hosted by Tony Rich.
The World Health Organization refers to obesity as a global epidemic in itself. Since 1975, the numbers have nearly tripled. In the United States, almost a third of the population is overweight. In Russia, some European countries, and South Africa, more than 20% are considered obese. Canada, parts of South America, and Australia also make up the top 20.
Studies provided more evidence that obese people are much more likely to die from coronavirus. Researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill found obese people had a 48% increase in death rates and are twice as likely to be hospitalized. The US and the UK have some of the highest obesity rates in the world, and the US still has, of course, the highest COVID-19 transmission rate.
With higher instances of diabetes, hypertension, and cardiovascular diseases among the general population due to obesity, South Africa is at particular risk for as long as there's no cure for COVID-19.
When compared to white Americans, black Americans have higher rates of chronic medical conditions linked to poor outcomes from COVID-19. 54% have hypertension, nearly 50% are obese, and more than 13% have diabetes.
We've known for many decades that poverty rates are more than twice as high in the African American community. And this, of course, goes hand in hand with healthcare access barriers, resulting in the very well documented higher diabetes, hypertension, and cancer death rates in African Americans compared to white Americans. So it was certainly predictable that we would see the frequency of COVID-19 is disproportionately higher in African Americans, and death rates from COVID-19 are disproportionately higher in African Americans.
The focus of this podcast is primarily nutrition, health, and obesity, and the implications in the teeth of this global pandemic that we're in. And as you've heard in those global news selections in the beginning, this is a very complicated issue to unpack. I wanted to have a conversation with an expert best positioned to give a science and evidence-based explanation of the relevant issues so that our listeners can understand the complexities. My guest for this podcast certainly did not disappoint. She is Dr. Michelle Cardell. She is an obesity and nutrition scientist, a registered dietitian, and associate professor in the Department of Health Outcomes and Biomedical Informatics at the University of Florida. She received her bachelor's degree in biology from Florida State University, and she was awarded a master's degree in clinical nutrition and a doctorate degree in nutrition sciences from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. She went on to complete her dietetic internship at UAB and the Alaskan Native Medical Center in Anchorage, Alaska. Her research is focused on understanding factors that contribute to the development of obesity and implementing treatment programs for obesity in underserved populations. Her specialties include nutrition, obesity, weight management, pediatric obesity, psychosocial factors contributing to obesity, and health disparities. As a Latina woman and scientist, she's very passionate about her work relating to nutrition and underserved populations, as well as diversity in the field of STEM, and particularly increasing underrepresented populations in STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and math. She's been recognized with awards in these areas, too numerous to review. I invite you to read her impressive bio in the show notes. So we spend the lion's share of the time talking about nutrition, obesity, and my goal was to try to discuss the science of the risk factors borne by clinical obesity and how science looks at and understands the mechanisms, if possible, of excess adiposity. I also get Dr. Cardell's perspective on a certain obesity counter-narrative coming from certain groups who would purport the idea of health at any size, or populations of clinically obese people can still be healthy on average over time. And she gives a very important response to that narrative. We talk about what we know and what's developing about obesity and risk factors related to COVID-19. Is science any closer to understanding the relationship between obesity, hospitalization rates, and fatalities? And we talk about the issues of race and how the communities, particularly our communities, both of our communities, the Latino and Black communities, disproportionate impact to the effects of COVID-19. And that's the lion's share of our conversation. And I pivot to talk about a little bit of nutrition and the nutrition practices of fitness enthusiasts, and whether or not so-called cleanses and detoxes have any validity, or what I call alternative nutrition concepts. We touch a little bit on supplements and dieting approaches. And then we finish up talking about disparities and the underrepresentation of women in science, technology, engineering, and math, and a lot of the work that Dr. Cardell has done to shed light on those issues. This was a very important and timely conversation, and I hope you get something out of it. So without further delay, I give you Dr. Michelle Cardell. All right, I am on with Dr. Michelle Cardell. Thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here with you today.
All right, I've been wanting to do a nutrition podcast for some time, and I've been following you on social media, and I wanted to get someone who was really knowledgeable to really have a good nutrition podcast and talk about some relevant events. And I'm glad you agreed. So, you know, maybe we should start off by telling our listeners what your background is, and in your own words, why you decided to focus on obesity and nutrition as your career ambition.
Yeah, absolutely. So I took a little bit of a unique path to arrive here. In undergraduate, my major was biology with a minor in chemistry. And I thought I wanted to be a physician because I wanted to help people. And I thought, you know, like many, the only careers I was exposed to were really like teacher, doctor, nurse, you know, lawyer type thing. Uh-huh. I did 3 medical mission trips when I was in college, and I clearly realized that that was not going to be my path moving forward. And so I went and I graduated college, and I decided to just go and backpack Europe, like many people do.
Right.
And during that time, I got to think about my experiences over those previous 4 years as an undergraduate. And the key components that really stood out to me was my work as a hospice volunteer. So I started, became a hospice volunteer when I was 19, and it was a life-changing experience for me. It's a real privilege and a real honor to be with people and with their families at the end of life. And really open up and share some very deep thoughts at the end of their life with you. And something that I heard a couple times over the course of the decade or so that I was a hospice volunteer, is this idea that patients were so worried that the choices that they had made impacted their quality of life at the end of life, as well as the way in which they died. And often I would hear people say things along the lines of, I fear that I killed myself with a fork. And, you know, as a 19-year-old starting this path, I definitely was not thinking about how the choices I made today would impact me over the lifespan. But it really prompted this interest in nutrition. And so while I was backpacking Europe and staying in hostels, I went to an internet cafe and paid by the minute for internet and applied to graduate school. And I applied and got accepted into a master's program. I did a master's in clinical nutrition, and it was during that master's program that I took my first ever nutrition classes. I'd never been exposed to nutrition before that. I went on to do a PhD in nutrition sciences, and in the middle of my PhD, decided to become a registered dietitian as well to kind of balance out the research training with more clinical training.
So you have a background in chemistry, nutrition, and obesity. So I think it's fair to say that you're highly qualified.
So I want to touch on COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch on obesity and also the impact to the minority community. So, you know, perhaps we'll start and talk about obesity generally. And so the CDC and WHO consider obesity a health problem. And so what I wanted to do is start and, you know, pretend we never heard the word obesity and hear from the mouth of a registered dietitian, a scientist, what is obesity and what's the evidence that obesity is in fact a health problem, and why excess adiposity causes some of these health problems, and does the location of body fat on a body influence the clinical diagnosis?
Yes, so these are all great questions. So to start off with the definition of obesity, so when we're talking about a population level, what we use is something called body mass index. And what it does is it's a ratio of your weight to your height. And if that number is a 30 or above, then you would be medically classified at a population level with obesity. So BMI works generally pretty good at a population level, but it is a horrific indicator of both obesity as well as health on an individual level. And so in order to determine obesity at an individual level, in an ideal situation, we're going to be doing a lot more testing. We're going to be doing things like measuring your body fat, if that's possible. And we're going to be taking a very patient-centered approach. Some patients are not interested in discussing their weight, and that is absolutely something that needs to be respected. And so I'm very careful with patients to say, A, is this something that you're interested in discussing? And B, what is the terminology that you feel most comfortable for me to utilize? There's a lot of consent that needs to be involved in discussing this incredibly vulnerable topic. And in terms of the evidence, there's a great body of literature characterizing the relationships between excess adiposity, which is really what we're talking about here. We're talking about excess levels of adipose tissue or fat. And that's why we need to go beyond this measure of BMI when really diagnosing obesity. But the relationship between excess levels of adipose tissue or body fat are associated with a variety of adverse medical complications, as well as psychological outcomes. So things like increased risk for heart disease, diabetes, you know, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Then also, it's important to note that obesity can also result in discrimination and stigmatization and bullying, and that these experiences, of course, can lead to depression, anxiety, and a variety of other psychological factors. And so it's important to note that the ramifications from obesity can be both physiological in nature, but also psychological in nature from the extreme weight stigma and discrimination that individuals with obesity experience across their life course.
Okay, so to summarize, BMI is appropriate as a screening tool for a normally distributed population. You have to drill down deeper with someone to get a very full understanding of the clinical diagnosis. Is that a good summary of what you stated there?
Absolutely. My first visit with a patient, I usually spend at least 60 minutes with them, diving deep into their medical history, their social history, doing a variety of assessments before any sort of diagnosis of obesity would be made.
That's important, what you just stated there, because I think there is a great deal of confusion about this in today's environment. When you hear statements that you can be health, quote unquote, healthy at any size, and then there's movements coming from various groups that they call them body positive, health at any size, and there's a narrative that we should be okay with obesity. And I wonder, from a scientist or a dietitian, how do you feel about some of these growing movements?
So I think the health at every size movement is probably the one that has taken on has the most influence,
mm-hmm. right?
And it's only getting bigger. And I would say that I agree with the majority of the components that come out of the health at every size movement,
mm-hmm.
focused on the significant problem of weight stigma and discrimination. Where I diverge from what Hayes advocates, and you can find this in their fact sheet, is that the idea that obesity is in and of itself not harmful for health. And I would strongly argue that the data is very clear. I mean, how do we explain something like non-alcoholic fatty liver disease if excess adiposity is not in and of itself a predictor of adverse health outcomes? What is challenging, and that I think is a fair point that's brought up, is that it's very difficult to disentangle the effects of weight stigma and discrimination from that of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true. What I can see, and what the data does show, we have a really interesting study under review right now, where we see that, there's two different components. One is that the 3-5% body weight loss reduces cardiometabolic risk factors. And that can be in individuals still maintaining what would be considered to be obesity, but that 3-5% reduction in body weight loss already improves cardiometabolic outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
In a paper that we have under review right now, we actually looked at nationally representative data in individuals who had undergone bariatric surgery. And those individuals who had undergone bariatric surgery, despite significant amounts of weight, their medical classification, their BMI still was elevated over a BMI of 30. Yet their cardiometabolic parameters paralleled those of individuals who had not experienced obesity and were medically classified in the healthy weight category.
Mm-hmm.
Do know that medical intervention, such as bariatric surgery, can be an extremely promising and effective treatment for individuals with obesity. Clearly, it's not for everyone, but we do have some excellent evidence-based treatments available.
I see. And cancers, what does the latest research, if you know about it, say about the correlation with some cancers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've seen studies, and cancer is certainly not my area, so I don't want to speak outside of my lane. But we do know that obesity is related to the prevalence of a variety of different cancers. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what I thought you were going to say, and I think if a fitness person like me says what you just said, they'll go, oh, another fitness person thinks they know it all, right? But I think it's important for people to hear that from someone like you, with that many letters after their name, to hear that. I mean, so we see a lot of this conversation right now happening, and you see circumstances where people will go through a transformation, like Adele, the singer Adele, went through a gigantic transformation, and so she sort of got attacked by some of these factions, because it when you go through a transformation and you may lose a lot of body fat, they see it as a betrayal, a sort of betrayal, and go after some people because of they think that they're not being true to their original self. And so there's this sort of squabble among factions about this issue. And I think it's just important to hear that from a scientist and a dietitian.
And I think it's really important to note that what people choose to do with their bodies is ultimately none of our business. Mm-hmm. And so I very much advocate the approach of not commenting on anyone's body shape or size for any reason.
Yeah.
It is not generally welcomed. Oftentimes, there's a lot of positive reinforcement for weight loss, but I have had patients who have lost a great deal of weight, not because it was intentional, but because they had an underlying medical issue like cancer.
Right.
So to be receiving all this positive feedback because they hadn't shared with people their cancer diagnosis was very damaging. And mm-hmm. It's hard for people to reconcile. And so I, in general, advocate the approach that somebody's body shape or size is not something that should ever be commented on one way or another, either in a positive manner or negative.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's move to COVID-19. Obesity has been listed as a risk factor, significant risk factor for COVID-19 by the CDC. And so I wanted to ask you about this. Are we seeing a strong relationship between obesity and hospitalization and fatality rates? And are we any closer in understanding this relationship here? And we've seen a significant effect in my community, the Black community. And how is that shaking out as far as the percentages of hospitalization rates among the minority communities?
Yeah, so I think it's impossible to talk about the relationships between COVID-19, obesity, and the disproportionate effect that it's had on Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities without talking about structural racism and discrimination. We know that there are very real barriers in place. I recently read Isabel Wilkerson's book, Cast. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that she wrote that book prior to COVID. Incredible how relevant this work is into understanding how we got to where we are. But the structural racism that's in place has resulted in not only a higher prevalence of obesity among racial ethnic minority populations, but has also put them at greater risk for infection and for poor access to care, and not just access, but differences in care. And so I think that that's a key component. Racial ethnic minorities are more likely to be essential workers. more likely to get exposed, more likely to live in communities and in housing situations that do not allow for physical or social distancing. And so I think it's very important to be focused on the policies and structures in place that have led to this, much more so than any sort of individual focus or particular blame.
Yeah. And do we know are we any closer to knowing the mechanism behind the increased hospitalization or the fatality rates with COVID-19? Are we any closer?
Yeah, I think, you know, the amount of scientific and medical progress that has been made since January of 2020, you know, it's October now, so over the last 10 months, is unlike anything else I have ever seen in my 15 years as a scientist. I feel like the world has come together, the medical and scientific community has come together to advance our understanding of the treatment of COVID-19 and what are the risk factors for it. My brother's an emergency medicine doctor, and the advances that they've made in treatment have been phenomenal. So every day we're learning a little bit more, but we still have a long way to go to really fully be able to characterize what is it that's driving this increased, mortality rate among individuals with obesity, particularly in these younger communities, which is where we're seeing some of the greatest effects.
Okay. Yeah. So I did see some of that research. And like you said, we already knew that there was a clinical risk to with obesity. And this just sort of drove home the exactly what you described there. So the CDC lists the social determinants of health as genetics, behavior, environmental and physical influences, medical care, and social factors. And so I'm wondering, with your experience as a dietitian and scientist, do you have a perspective on how to implement policy so that we could solve this problem? And what are the factors that are needed in a total solution?
Yes, so there's many people certainly much more qualified than me to talk about the policies that mm-hmm. should be implemented to address the issues of systemic racism, discrimination, and other social factors that lead to these social determinants of health. What I can touch on is based on some of the work that I've done looking at the relationships between experiences of discrimination, of stress, of poverty, of perceiving oneself to be of lower social standing than others. All of these factors are playing a role in the development of cardiometabolic disease and in the severity of cardiometabolic disease. And so my research and the work of others really shows that poverty, inequity, that these factors in and of themselves create an obesogenic environment. Yeah. And so as a society, I think we need to move to be a more equitable culture in terms of income equity, education equity, and a variety of other factors.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, fitness enthusiasts that listen to this podcast, and many are really highly motivated people, you know, people who do marathons, triathlons, and Ironman distance triathlons and such. And so is there something to be said for the lifestyle component? So all those things that you described are absolutely valid. So is there anything that can be done with respect to the nutrition and lifestyle component educating the populace at large about nutrition, trying to get better understanding of disadvantaged populations, about lifestyle choices and things like that. Where do you land on that side of it?
Yeah, so I mean, I am a behavioralist. I actually do conduct lifestyle interventions. I currently have a 5-year funded grant from the National Institute of Health to implement a healthy lifestyle intervention for adolescents with overweight and obesity. So I very much believe in the lifestyle at the individual level. But I think to make population level change, that we'll be making these changes at the policy base level.
Yeah.
It is a real privilege to be able to decide what type of diet one wants to follow. One of the things people often ask me is, people make lots of assumptions about what I eat and how I eat because of, you know, the work that I do. People will assume that I'm vegan, that I'm low carb, that I,
right.
You know, whatever, you know, take your pick.
Yeah.
Free. I eat only organic. And the reality is that I'm in a very privileged position where I could eat any of those ways. And many of my patients do not have that privilege and that opportunity. From my experience, the issue of what we've seen in the data, the increased prevalence of obesity over the last 50 years, people often want to limit it down to a knowledge deficit.
Yeah.
Well, we simply, taught people more about nutrition, then that alone would be enough to close that knowledge deficit and attenuate the increased prevalence of obesity. And what I have seen in my own practice, but also in the scientific literature, is that the knowledge gap is not the driving force of these increases in obesity prevalence. The food environment in which we live, the obesogenic environment in which we have, 24/7 access to highly palatable, low cost, very energy, like high calorie, delicious food. The way it's marketed particularly to low income communities, the way it's marketed to children, all of these things play a role in the development of obesity. And that's what makes obesity such a challenging disease to study, because it's multifactorial and it's so complex and it doesn't present a way in any two patients.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything you're saying there is true. Coming up, I can, only speak from experience. I definitely saw exactly what you described. I mean, so when you grow up in the inner city and you realize that, quote unquote, healthy food is so expensive, mm-hmm. and it's so easy to go get, fast food when you're working multiple jobs and you're just trying to feed your family, that fast food is readily available. So I definitely saw that, and I see it from, I've seen it from the other side too. I've seen behaviors about activity and health where just this sort of an adverse reaction towards activity. I've seen that. So if a total solution is out there, it almost certainly would be a multifactorial solution to the problem.
Absolutely.
Mm. You talked about nutrition, so I wanted to pivot to this because you touched on a little bit of it. Fad diets, supplements, and I see this a lot in the endurance enthusiast community, of the fitness enthusiast community, And oftentimes, if you tell an athlete that something is going to benefit their performance, they will run out and do it. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if you have seen a lot of this activity out, particularly on social media. There's detoxes, so-called cleanses, and you know, people propagating what I'm calling alternative nutrition. Mm-hmm. And so I want to get your thoughts on this. What have you seen out there that are sort of the most egregious examples of this? And if you can touch on this idea that you can sort of detox, is there anything that can detox your body outside of kidneys and livers? Yeah, is there anything that can detox your body? And what do you make of this? It's new. It's almost like a religion.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And just like religion, people get very upset if you question.
Yes, of course.
Whatever it is that they have put so much into. And in general, I take the approach of if it hurt you, then and you want to pursue it, then that's fine. More power to you. But in terms of my advice, it would be that if anyone is trying to sell you a tea, a juice, a pill, a supplement, and is promising that this is going to change your life, change your weight, I would run. I would run from that individual because they are capitalizing on your vulnerabilities and selling you on what you want, you know, potentially than anything in the world. In the case of athletes, it's to be fitter, stronger, faster. In my field and the individuals with obesity, many of my patients have been struggling with their weight their entire life. And they feel as though they have somehow failed. Mm-hmm. They have often tried any and all of these things, hoping that one of these things will be the magic cure. But none of these things, unless it's being prescribed by your physician and it is an evidence-based treatment, That's a totally different ballgame. But anything that is a supplement, supplements are not regulated by the FDA. People often don't realize that. Supplements can say that they have 100 times the needed daily value of this particular vitamin, and it may have 10% of that. Mm-hmm. Have 1,000 times what it says on the bottle. And so if somebody is set on purchasing supplements, the only supplements I recommend are the ones that have been tested by an independent consumer-based company. So something like the USP label can indicate to you that independent consumer-based company has come in and tested that what this supplement company claims is in there is actually in there. Mm-hmm. B, the second component, is that your body's actually going to be able to metabolize that supplement and that it's not just going to sit into your stomach and turn into either expensive urine or expensive stool.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so is there anything that you can ingest that can detox you?
Your kidneys and your livers do,
do that.
They do a phenomenal job of detoxing. And what people, whenever I see these things, I'm always curious as to what is it exactly that they're trying to detox. And they usually say something along the lines of like dangerous chemicals and
yeah.
There's never any sort of like clear
toxins.
Toxins, yes. Those darn dangerous toxins. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a religion. It's like religion. And then, and again, if I say it, it's, oh, this fitness guy doesn't know he's talking, but they think they know everything. I think they need to hear it from people like you, a scientist, a doctor, a dietitian. But even still,
Even still, sometimes they don't.
Yeah, you probably on Twitter will get into an argument with a 16-year-old kid, probably talking about whatever diet. So these diets: ketogenic, paleo, Atkins. Any thoughts on these? I mean, I've not seen a lot of evidence that they. Many of them work the way that it is described. Intermittent fasting, that these are, you know, seem to be just extreme ways of getting to negative energy balance, but maybe risky or just extreme. If you were to give someone a recommendation of, you know, as a registered dietitian, knowing that you need to get complete information about someone's entire lifestyle, if you were to give just sort of high level general approach to listeners on healthy eating, what would you say as a scientist, as a dietitian?
So the studies are pretty clear that it's less about what you eat in terms of macronutrient composition, of what percent of your diet comes from carbs or fat. And much more about compliance. So ultimately, compliance reigns queen in diet wars. What can you eat and have a high quality of life and feel good, and it fits within your social needs, and you can do it over the long term? And, you know, that may take some trial and error, but keep at it until you find something that works for you. General guidelines, again, this is not taking into account any sort of medical issues or social needs or anything else that may determine what an individual would need. But in general, kind of aiming for at least half of your plate to be fruits and vegetables, eating lean sources of protein, eating lots of, you know, seeds, nuts, plants, you know, it's, in general, it's, the consensus is out there. If you look at the majority of individuals in the nutrition world, there is general consensus over what constitutes a healthy diet. There's other varieties, like things like a ketogenic diet, that can absolutely be part of a healthful way of eating, particularly for individuals, you know, with type 2 diabetes, for example. Mm-hmm. The idea that there's one right way to eat, I think is ludicrous based on the data that we have available now.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that. okay. I want to finish up and talk about, so you've done a lot of work based upon your bio. You've done a lot of work in diversity and inclusion, is that correct?
I try to dedicate a great deal of my time and efforts to that space, absolutely.
I see. And you've published work highlighting the issue of disparities and inequities in STEM. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you might be able to tell our listeners about that work. What is the nature of that problem? And if you have a perspective on how to resolve it, you can feel free to offer that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think the data very much speaks for itself. There is a very large body of evidence to suggest that gender inequities, as well as inequities for underrepresented racial ethnic minorities, individuals with disabilities, individuals from the LGBTQIA+ community experience a great deal of inequities within STEM. And so we are seeing some of those inequities magnified. Right now, during the COVID-19 epidemic, we've seen a higher proportion of women drop out of the workforce relative to men. I just recently wrote a paper on what we fear will be a secondary epidemic to COVID-19 in terms of the loss of early career women scientists and women STEM workers. We know that, especially during stay-at-home orders, even in households where both parents of the household are high achieving professionals within STEM, we still see a disproportionate responsibility placed on women in terms of the household domain, whether that be with regarding children, elder care, or with household responsibilities like cleaning and things like that. Similar across these inequities, I think the burden is on institutions to put policies in place to help their STEM workers not just survive in the workforce, but to thrive. And that creates that means creating dedicated resources and safety nets for women, for people of color, and from people from other marginalized communities. And now more than ever, I think we're going to need those support systems in place if we want to maintain a diverse workforce. I very much fear what the secondary ramifications of COVID are going to be on the diversity of the workforce.
And we should probably mention that you are a Latina woman, correct?
Yes, my family's from Puerto Rico.
Okay, so a Latina woman in STEM. You are truly one in a million. So I work in STEM. I'm trained as a data scientist. So I definitely see what you're describing. And so the paper that you wrote, is that your Chutes and Ladders?
Mm-hmm. That's one of them. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll put the link to it in the show notes so people can see it. And I've also been pulled into many of these discussions now about disparities. I was on a podcast with a chess grandmaster, my name is Maurice Ashley, and we were talking about chess. He's actually the first Black grandmaster. And he said that the disparities in chess were 90% men, 10% women. And he said he was being very generous on that 10%, he said. And I've been pulled into a lot of conversations about this with athletics. So, and I'm trying to figure out, whenever we see a disparity, is the reason always a nefarious one? And I don't know what the answer is. So another way to look at it is, if you were to do a thought experiment and you could eliminate the entire world of any bias, racism, bias, prejudice, is it reasonable that we would see parity across every genre of work? Chess federations with swimmers. I've been pulled into a lot of conversations about athletics and swimming. How come we don't see Black swimmers and such? So, what would you say to that as a scientist? If we could wave a magic wand and be in a world free of bias, free of racism, free of gender discrimination, would we see parity across every genre of everything? I don't know the answer. I have done that myself. So the question is really, what is the sort of intrinsic disparity that you could expect? I don't know the answer. So it's an interesting thought experiment, but I think sometimes, yes, you can absolutely use racism to account for a disparity or some type of structural issue. Sometimes it may just be the case that there's a disparity for another reason. I don't know what those reasons are, but any thoughts, any perspective there?
Sure. I mean, to imagine a world without racism, bias, discrimination, I don't know that that type of world has ever existed. I'm hopeful that it's possible, but we have a lot of work to do before we get anywhere even close to that.
Yeah, but it's a thought experiment. I mean,
it's a great question.
Maybe it would be. Maybe they would be in that environment. There would be parity, complete parity. Construction working would be 50% men, 50% women. Nursing would be 50% men and 50% women. Teaching would be 50% men, 50% women. Human resources and so on. Maybe there would be complete parity.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even then the socialization and the gender norms and the social norms that were taught at such a young age already, you know, start to come through. So we'd almost have to create a brand, like go back to the drawing board, start a brand new society, and take out a lot of these caste systems in place.
Mm-hmm.
Created a lot of these inequities across these different groups.
Yeah, and you're shedding some light on some important issues that absolutely need to be dealt with in the minority community, especially. We simply don't have enough minorities in STEM, and we need to do more to figure out how we can create some more balance in these underrepresented communities, for sure. Well, we covered a lot, and you've already been really generous with your time. And so how do people find you out on social media, and which platforms are you most active on?
I am very active on Twitter and Facebook, and you can find me at Michelle Cardell on both Twitter and Facebook. I have a Facebook professional page, and on Instagram as Dr. Michelle Cardell as well. So I love to meet people via social media. So please don't hesitate to reach out.
All right. And make sure that you check out the Facebook page, because she's got some great recipes on there that I see her post periodically. And I will put all of her information in the show notes, and you can read her very impressive biography. One of the most impressive biographies I've ever seen in the nutrition. And it's, you know, pretty amazing. And all the work that you're doing with diversity and inclusion is absolutely amazing. So I thank you for, you know, taking the time to have this conversation.
Thank you, Tony, for all the wonderful work that you're doing. I really appreciate being invited on the show.
Thanks again to Dr. Michelle Cardell. All of the links to her work are in the show notes. Also, I'm going to ask that everyone go out and follow her on Facebook and Twitter. The links to her social media platforms are also in the show notes. And you need to run there right now, and click follow. I guarantee you'll be glad you did. I felt very proud and honored to speak with her. She is truly an amazing individual. And she has a confluence of expertise and a presence that leads me to believe she's going to be a very big influencer with respect to all of the issues that she is shedding light on and talked about on the podcast. So mark my words. So as you know, I always do a quick little afterword on the podcast on the concept of obesity. I think Dr. Cardell effectively conveyed the seriousness of clinical obesity. I feel it's incredibly important for people with her expertise to say, yes, in fact, there is a confluence of empirical evidence of the risks borne by clinical obesity or excess adiposity. That's obvious in the fact that she has dedicated her entire life to helping with this global problem. But you'd be surprised how many professionals have been essentially strong-armed into remaining silent. They sometimes see this as a sort of third-rail conversation or the crossfire among factions represents too much of a liability, or they themselves have bought into a counter-narrative. And we absolutely have to have an unwavering commitment to the facts and the science, regardless of how inconvenient they are. On the podcast, we previously talked about confirmation bias, which is the tendency for someone to buy into a certain narrative and then seek out only evidence that they think agrees with that narrative and reject all of the mountains of evidence that demonstrate that that narrative is false. And we see these forms of confirmation bias play out with people, and no one is immune to confirmation bias, regardless of one's political leanings. I've seen this on the left and on the right. As an example, as we talked about in the podcast, so those that would decree by fiat that humans can be clinically obese and not be at risk on average and still be healthy on average. So this is an example, in my opinion, of confirmation bias. And is this any different than telling people you don't have to wear a mask in a pandemic? I would argue that, you know, this would be as problematic. So we have to have an unwavering commitment to the facts, regardless of how inconvenient. And I think Dr. Cardell is one of the impressive professionals that are standing up for science and evidence-based teachings. I have also in my notes that people are, you know, too often getting wrapped around the axle arguing about BMI. Anyone who knows anything about data understands heuristics, which is what BMI is. It's a heuristic designed as a screening approach to draw broad conclusions about a normally distributed population. And as Dr. Cardell said, BMI is an appropriate screening approach for a normally distributed population. So all of these examples about, well, what about LeBron James? The BMI would say he's obese. Well, isn't that just too easy? LeBron James, a guy that's almost 7 feet tall, he wouldn't be considered a part of a normally distributed population of humans. And so screens are really just introductory. And as Dr. Cardell said, there's much more that goes on. You know, doctors will ask so many questions, run so many tests, run so many panels, and we leave it to the doctors to render clinical diagnoses. Dr. Cardell spoke very passionately about the social determinants of health and health inequities in underserved populations. And I agree 100%. As you know, we had a podcast with Dr. Corey A. Baer, And he also spoke about this, and we devoted quite a bit of time to that topic on that podcast. And so I've dedicated now three full podcasts on this topic with Corey Hebert, Michelle Cardell, and if you remember, in the first season, we talked to Stephen Guillenet. And they all had very similar comments and testimony about health, nutrition, obesity, inequities, and so on. And so what I would like to see at some point is, what's going to be the solution? And I know many of these experts that we talk to, they're not policymakers, but I want to know what is going to be that multifactorial solution that we need to put forth. Because my fear is this continues to get kicked down the road, a can that keeps getting kicked down the street. And, you know, people say, well, first step, solve racism. And then the can gets kicked down the road. I can tell you from experience, having many years of working in STEM, that there is absolutely asymmetry in the working environment in STEM with women, with minorities. And it's not just getting in to STEM fields. Even after you get in, there's all sorts of issues like unconscious bias, issues where, you know, people will take credit for your work or, you know, discredit your work, but then take it and then get credit for work that you previously had, you know, already brought forth and was previously discredited. Things like that, you know, people not acknowledging the work that you do, glass ceilings, slippery walls, all of it. And sometimes that can drive people out of the industry completely. And people just go off and just start their own business or do whatever they need to do to survive. For many years and decades working, I didn't put a picture on LinkedIn for many of these reasons that I've described, right? So, you know, I figured I could go to a job interview and show up and then win them with my communication abilities and my experience. But I thought that if they saw a picture, they just wouldn't call me. So needless to say, I think the work that she is doing in this space is incredibly valuable. As I mentioned in the conversation in this podcast, I have been brought into a number of different conversations about disparities, particularly in athletics. And there's been an increased call for this ever since the spring. And I've been asked to speak on some panels and get involved in discussion in some of my coaching communities. So, for instance, some of the questions have been, why don't we see more black swimmers, for instance? And what can we do about it? How come we don't see more black athletes in X sport, and what can we do about it? So this recently has caused me to reflect on the question of disparities generally, but particularly in the space of athletics. And so I suspect that these are also multifactorial, right? And but the question is, do we always move to assign a coefficient to the most nefarious factor? And that's what I'm mulling over, and that was the reason for my question about disparities and the thought experiment that I've thought about myself, right? In the absence of bias, would we still see disparities? I don't know the answer to that question, but perhaps there's some non-nefarious reasons, like, you know, cultural preferences, just to name one. And that's an honest question, and regardless, I think we need to continue to have open dialogue, and people need to be free to come to the table with their honest questions, and all parties would need to come to the table from an emotionally detached perspective so we can have that dialogue and understand the nature of problems and even potentially pose some solutions. And that's what we do here on the Endurance Experience podcast, and so hopefully we'll continue to have more discussions like the one we had today. Thanks again for listening.
Follow Event Horizon Endurance Sport on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for training programs and services to become a member of our Endurance Institute, or for a complete archive of podcasts, log on to our website, eventhorizon.tv.